2016 was a big year in news. A new president was elected. The Black Lives Matter movement gained steam due to an increased focus on police shootings. There were protests, both political and environmental. And then there were the mass shootings, which claimed the lives of thousands. Tonight, we take a look back at the news that shaped Florida in 2016, recapping our top three stories of the year. That's ahead on It's About Florida. Welcome to It's About Florida. I'm Lynn Hatter. Our first story of the evening comes from the summer, as researchers scrambled to find a cure for the Zika virus, which causes birth defects in children. Florida has been one of the top two states in the nation for Zika infections. The disease came ashore earlier this year after ravaging South America and U.S. territories like Puerto Rico. To date, more than 4,500 cases of the virus have been confirmed in the U.S. In April, during the height of the outbreak, we spoke with Hayden Perry, CEO of the company Oxitec. The company had developed a mosquito to combat the Zika virus. Can you tell us a little bit more about what your company has developed?
Okay, so what we've developed is a genetically engineered mosquito. So what we do is we actually release males, because males actually don't bite. Every mosquito that's ever bitten you has been a female. So we release males, the males go out there, they mate with the females, and then the offspring die. So that's literally the center point of what we do. So we send out the males, they mate with females, the offspring die. Now if you do this, what we've shown is that we can reduce the mosquito population in a town by over 90% in about 6 months, which is hugely better than you can achieve through the use of conventional insecticides.
I think one of the questions I have is, do mosquitoes commingle? So your mosquito is one type of mosquito. Does it only target that same type of mosquito? Or when you release the males, do they say, hey, there's a pretty lady over there? You know, how do you keep them targeting the same group?
Not all mosquitoes are the same. So there's many thousands of species of mosquito. So this one, Aedes aegypti, which is the one that spreads dengue and Zika virus, only mates with Aedes aegypti. Uh-huh. It doesn't mate with anything else. In fact, if you force it to mate, which is, again, one of the things we've done just to sort of rule off all possibilities, if you force it to mate with another species, it doesn't produce any offspring. Oh. So it's really only mating with its own. Now, you are right that some species of mosquitoes form what they call a species complex. Mm-hmm. So you can get some cross-mating. So you can get in the Culex species, which is the one that spreads West Nile, you can, in some of those species, you can get, you know, Culex pipiens mating with another Culex species like Quinquefasciatus. But in the Aedes, which is the one we're worried about, they only go after their own species.
So the particular type of mosquito that spreads Zika, it's an invasive mosquito. Where does it come from? What's its point of origin?
So this one is called Aedes aegypti. So and so as the name suggests, it actually comes out of North Africa. So the real meaning of the word is Aedes from Egypt, Aedes aegypti. So that's where it's come from, and it's spread itself around the world. So it's the same mosquito from Miami to Buenos Aires to Kuala Lumpur, Singapore. I mean, it's the same right the way across the world in terms of the capacity to spread dengue and Zika. And it's transported itself not by flying. People think mosquitoes fly around.
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah, and it's extraordinary. They really don't fly very far. So the mosquito that bites you is, apart from being, you know, only being a female, the mosquito that bites you has actually emerged, been hatched out, and has lived all its life within 200 yards of where it bit you. Oh. It really doesn't fly very far. The way they actually transport themselves around the world is that we do it for them. They come on ships, they come in planes, they come in cars, as eggs. So the simplest way to think about this is if you imagine a port with containers being loaded onto ships, and you imagine it rains and you get little puddles of water forming on top of the containers, then the mosquito, the female, will come along, lay her eggs around that water, sun dries up the water, eggs then transported on top of the container from one country to another. And what you're doing is you're actually transporting a whole population, a breeding population, 100, 200, 300 eggs of males and females. When you arrive at the other end, and it rains again, then they hatch out.
Most of our cases in Florida of the Zika virus have been travel-related. So what's the application of having a disease preventer in place where it's not the mosquito causing the problem, but the place where the people are traveling from?
Okay, so the danger here or the risk here is that you will get local transmission. Because what you've got here in Florida, and indeed in other parts of the US, is you have the mosquito every day, you know, in all the towns. Now, if any one of those people come back from abroad with Zika in their blood, if they're bitten by an Aedes aegypti female, and then that female goes off and bites other people, you could get local transmission. So one case could lead to hundreds and then thousands. So that's the risk, and that's what we need to prevent.
Can this technique be applied to other species?
Yeah. Yes, it can. I mean, we kicked off with working on Aedes aegypti because we saw that single species was by far the most dangerous. But we're also developing exactly the same process in a mosquito called Aedes albopictus, which is often called the tiger mosquito. It's a really nasty biter. It's not actually very good at transmitting disease, but boy, you know when you've been bitten, and it ruins your life.
Really? What happens?
Yeah. It's just it doesn't ruin your life in a dramatic sense. I mean, it's just a really nasty bite. It gives you a big welt. Yeah. So you can get instances where Aedes albopictus, the tiger, spreads dengue or chikungunya. It's not that common, to be honest, but you can get it. So that's the next on our list, and we're developing that. And then we're also thinking about, but haven't started, the Culex mosquitoes, the one that spreads West Nile.
When you achieve a 90% death rate, essentially, have you seen any ecological repercussions in the areas you've studied? What happens when you kill 90% of something?
Okay, so the answer is no, we haven't seen that. And yes, we have monitored that. But imagine, for example, that you're looking at taking 90% of these mosquitoes out. But they're only 1% of the mosquitoes that you're coming across. Mm-hmm. So it's 90% of the 1%. So actually, in terms of the total mosquito population and the food that mosquitoes provide for bats or ants, then you know, you're really not making any impact at all. But actually, the impact you will see is actually a beneficial one. Because what do people do now? People use insecticides. Now, insecticides will actually wipe out all insect life. The spiders, the beneficial insects like bees, etc. So with an insecticide, it's a bit like a sort of blunderbuss. You're going to take out everything that it comes across. Whereas what we're doing, of course, is just going, what's the one target that we're after? Let's tackle that. So the theoretical impact, if you like, ecologically, is greater biodiversity. But you're only the other point to make, I suppose, is we're only actually talking about towns. If you go out into the Everglades or wherever, you don't find Aedes aegypti. Mm-hmm. It doesn't live there. It only lives in towns because the only thing it bites is humans. So once you go outside the town or into a forest or into a woodland area, you find lots of other mosquitoes, but you don't find this one. Clearly, if you've got a human habitation, you could well find it. Because they've got it, they bite humans. That's all they do.
We can target now different mosquitoes that do different things, from the Aedes aegypti to the tiger mosquito. Do we risk creating an imbalance? So if we kill 90% of the 1%, what happens when we knock off 80% of them all?
So the beauty of our technology is that it's self-limiting. So when you often think about genetic engineering, you think about things spreading or persisting or staying in the environment. And that's the exact opposite with our case. Every mosquito we release will die, its offspring will die. Mm-hmm. Now, so then you come back to really the mosquito biology. It only flies 200 yards. So we're sitting in Tallahassee. We could control the mosquitoes in one corner of Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. And would have no effect on the mosquitoes in the rest of the town, city, and that's because this is only going to work in the areas where you release the mosquito. So it only works where you want it to work, because any mosquito that we release will only fly 200 yards, the offspring will then die. So it's really very controlled.
Speculation continues into what, if any, role Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi will have in President-elect Donald Trump's administration. Bondi is a longtime Trump supporter, now serving on his transition team. But that support got her in hot water earlier this year. At the center of the controversy, allegations Bondi dropped an investigation into Trump University in return for a campaign donation. Nothing to that effect was ever proven, but it's hounded Bondi ever since. It's about Florida panelists Tramell Gomes, Politico Florida's Matt Dixon, and Tampa Bay Times' Michael Oslin discussed that donation back in September. Welcome to It's About Florida, Matt, Michael, and Tramell Gomes. Thank you all for joining us in studio today.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Thanks. So today we're going to talk about this ongoing issue of the $25,000 donation that Donald Trump made to Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi back in 2014. That became an issue earlier this year. And I want to talk about how we have gotten to this point. You now have U.S. House Democrats calling for an investigation. You now have the New York Attorney General who has launched an investigation into Trump's charity. How did we get here? Where did the saga begin? And for that, we're going to turn to Matt.
Well, it started in 2013, actually. It's become new news a little bit on the national scale, but there isn't a lot of new meat here. But basically how it started in 2013, the Orlando Sentinel, I believe, was actually the first organization to report that the $25,000 contribution to General Bondi's political committee came from a Trump Foundation. Shortly, I believe it was a four-day span between the check and when she decided not to get involved in a class action lawsuit brought by the New York Attorney General. And there was some stories about it back then, and not a lot came from it. And it reared up again when Bondi decided to endorse Trump just this March, endorse his presidential campaign. And a lot of people started talking about that story again. Bondi was an early endorser when a lot of Republicans weren't necessarily with Trump. So then it kind of popped up again. And the third, I think, sort of wave is the Washington Post recently reported that Trump actually had to pay a fine to the IRS because the foundation that he used to give the contribution isn't allowed to give campaign contributions. So that's really – that fine is sort of the newest chunk of news that we have outside of perhaps partisan investigations. The new real chunk of news is that he has had to pay a fine, and it was indeed an illegal contribution. And those are sort of the three or four steps from 2013 when this started to where we are today.
Yeah, and he had to pay that fine because it came out of a charity, and charities are not allowed to give – political contributions. Now, Michael, one of the things, you know, Pam Bondi said early on about this was, well, I tried to give it back and it was rejected. They wouldn't allow me to give it back. But she's actually been pressed a little bit more on, you know, were you actually investigating this? You know, why didn't you go forward with that Trump U lawsuit that other states have filed? And she's been kind of cagey on that one.
Cagey is a pretty good word to describe how both Trump and Bondi have been through this whole process when they're pressed by reporters on the issue. Her political committee did try to return the donation after it came out in the news that it was an illegal contribution because of tax laws, and the Trump Foundation rejected that attempt to sort of reimburse that. But on the subject of whether or not she was considering an investigation, it's pretty clear from internal emails that higher ups in Bondi's office knew about these complaints. I mean, there were more than 20 complaints beginning when Bill McCollum was Attorney General and well into Bondi's tenure. That had to do with Trump University. So people in Bondi world knew about Trump University. And so to suggest that they were never considering an investigation suggests that they were just looking at the complaints and not thinking about what to do with them. Whether or not the Attorney General herself was personally thinking about an investigation, that's what we don't know at this point.
do we buy that it was just, you know, oops, our bad. It wasn't supposed to be paid out of the charity account. It was supposed to be paid, you know, out of another account. And would this be a story if it had been paid out of Trump's checking account other than the charity?
Do we buy it? No, you wouldn't buy it unless there weren't instances of this happening before in the past. I think there are evidence of similar type contributions being made out of the Trump Foundation, which is under scrutiny for the way it operates, in the sense that, he's not even really utilizing his own money, as you were talking about. If he had given his own funds to the campaign, he doesn't do that. He gets money that goes into this foundation for charitable purposes, and he does with it as he sees fits. He does provide some charitable work, but in one of the newspaper or investigation, it shows that it's closely tied to something that benefits him, or if he's pressured, like when during the many televised debates, when he's pressured to make donations, that's when he goes in and releases those funds to different organizations. So it's all over the place.
I actually tend to think that I buy the accounting error story with the
that it was an accounting error. It wasn't supposed to be paid out of the charity, but through a series of steps, that's
correct.
What happened.
Yeah, I actually buy that story because Trump has, through other accounts and through himself personally and Ivanka Trump as well, they have contributed a lot of money to Florida politics. I'm not as scandalized by the fact that this came from the foundation account versus his personal account. I think that the questions worth asking are more in the line of, was he expecting the attorney general to not act, or was he perhaps giving her money in hopes of keeping her in office because she hadn't acted already? I think those are really important questions worth asking. Whether or not it was supposed to come from a charitable organization or not is sort of, I think, missing the bigger picture.
And, you know, I think she was rumored as a possible 2018, like, dark horse gubernatorial candidate, as you noted, congressional aspirations floating around. It's kind of nebulous. But I will say this, though. You haven't seen much of Pam Bondi recently on national television, which has been one of her most powerful messaging tools. She was a former Fox News analyst. Well, I don't know if I should say former, but I mean, she was a Fox News analyst. She had been a frequent guest there. You haven't seen her on television as much. And, you know, you haven't seen her around Tallahassee that much. And you haven't really seen her.
Well, last week she was on Neil Cavuto, sort of defending herself on Fox. I don't remember if it was Fox Business or Fox News, one of his shows. Other than that, I mean, she doesn't usually do a lot of public appearances in Tallahassee anyway.
It's really hot up here.
It is. Yeah. It is. We don't have very many beaches. Right. So it's understandable. But, she has been more under the radar. She's pretty commonly on TV and you know, people see her around town in Tampa and things like that. I mean, I think this is a tough time to be Pam Bondi. As Matt noted, she's taking the brunt of this. And, you know, she's a pretty well-known figure in Florida, but the rest of the country is just learning who she is and whatever her future is. I think we're going to hear a fourth wave of this story whenever Pam Bondi, you know, declares for her next office, whatever that may be.
Finally tonight, our top story of the year. In June, a gunman killed 49 people and wounded 53 others in what would become the deadliest attack in the United States since September 11th. It happened at the Pulse nightclub, a gay club in Orlando, and its impact continues to reverberate across the state. Florida Public Radio member station WMFE has been covering that story. Here's a look back with Abe Abaraya and Brendan Byrne. More than 40 patients flooded the Orlando Regional Medical Center. Medical staff there were pushed to the limit as they dealt with the onslaught of patients coming from the Pulse nightclub. WMFE health reporter Abe Abaraya was at a press conference where medical staff and patients recounted the events of early Sunday morning. And we should mention before we get started, Some listeners may find the details in this report disturbing.
26-year-old Angel Cologne was with three friends that Saturday night into Sunday morning. They all survived. But when the shooting started, Cologne was shot three times in the leg and wasn't able to move. He was trampled by the crowd. And then, he says, the shooter began executing people who were wounded inside the club.
I look over and he shoots the girl next to me. And I'm just there laying down. I'm thinking, I'm next. I'm dead. So I don't know how, but by the glory of God, he shoots towards my head, but it hits my hand. And then he shoots me again, and it hits the side of my hip.
Cologne managed to stay calm for hours until police shot and killed the gunman. An officer found Angel Cologne alive on the floor, sitting in a wheelchair at a press conference. He says without the hospital staff, he wouldn't be alive.
And he grabs my hand, and he's like, this is the only way that I can take you out. I'm like, please carry me, because I'm in pain right now. Couldn't walk or anything. So he starts to drag me out across the street to the Wendy's, and I'm grateful for him, but the floor is just covered in glass.
Even though Orlando Regional Medical Center was just three blocks away, it wasn't easy getting Cologne and others there. Because the scene was unsafe, it was impossible to get EMS into the club, so the injured were taken to the hospital in the back of police pickup trucks and civilian cars, any way to get them there. In total, 28 surgeries the first night and 16 since. Dr. Joseph Ibrahim says they've had to bring patients back in for repeat surgeries.
We're seeing some things now with this high caliber rifle causing injury, soft tissue injury that we talk about, that are causing some destruction and some of the tissues having issues now, so that now we have to go back and debride some of those wounds.
Doctors say these were the kinds of injuries seen in a war because of the type of rifle and how close the shooter was to his victim. They said if Pulse hadn't been three blocks away, many of these patients would not have made it to the hospital alive. I'm Abe Abaraya.
For more on our conversation, we turn to WMFE reporter Brendan Byrne. Brendan, tell us what all has happened since Sunday, since news of this shooting broke.
We're still learning details about what happened. The Orlando police have been briefing the press, talking about what happened. We know for sure that there was a shooting between the shooter at the club about 2 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, and at about 5 o'clock in the morning, 3 hours later, SWAT breached an exterior wall to release hostages and get in a gunfight with the shooter. We don't know really what happened in between. We're starting to put the pieces together, looking at social media posts and witness statements as they're coming in, but we don't really have a good grasp of what's going on. Now, in the community has really stepped up and come together. There was a call for blood donation after, you know, the 50-some people that were in the hospital. Lines for blood donation wrapped around blocks. They were turning people away. Blood banks were reaching capacity. Folks, local businesses were donating food to the workers, the press that were out there, the first responders. They really just kind of stepped up and really helped out in this tragedy.
You know, one of the things that I think a lot of people are wondering, and you referenced it a little bit, is what may have happened when SWAT finally intervened. And we've seen some reports that are suggesting that maybe some of the people who were injured in this may have actually been injured or wounded or killed kind of at that point. What is law enforcement saying about that?
So Orlando Police Chief John Mina hasn't really commented about he said that they're looking, that is part of their investigation, but he has not released any details on that. He did say that when SWAT did make the breach, the backdrop of the shooter was concrete, that they weren't shooting into hostages at that point. We don't know how that investigation is going, how long that will take, but right now the reports of so-called friendly fire are unconfirmed from us.
Gotcha. You know, as this goes on, what is still left to learn about the shooter? I know a lot, there is a policy, some people do hold it, of whether or not, you know, to name him. For this show, I think that we're going to elect not to name him. But what do we know about him, his upbringing, and sort of what may have led to this attack on that nightclub on Pulse?
We're still getting details of his life. There's been plenty of reports about that. What we do know for sure is he was born in New York to Afghan parents. He spent some time in Stuart, Florida, as a kid, I believe in middle school. Lived in Fort Pierce. That's where he had his apartment. He had a wife previous and then was married with a second wife. And they were living in that apartment in Fort Pierce. But we're starting to get some more details on his social life. You know, there are some reports that he had been to that nightclub before. Now, that nightclub is a gay nightclub. There are some reports that he had interacted with folks in the gay community via a social media app to hook up. But, you know, when his wife spoke with reporters and AP, she said, you know, he didn't show any homosexual tendencies or anything like that, but they are looking into that. Now, it should be said that not all of the patrons at Pulse are homosexual, but it is a gay themed club. So we're starting to learn those details about him. He seemed conflicted in conversations with police during that hostage situation, pledging allegiance. Or I'm sorry, I've got to go back, Lynn.
Sure, go ahead.
The FBI did look into his look into allegations raised in 2013, I believe, where folks thought that he was a threat, and he said, you know, that he had allegiance to two separate terrorist organizations that FBI investigators said would not be. Would not be cooperative. They were both enemies, basically. So he seemed. We're still kind of putting the details together, but it doesn't seem like a stable person.
This shooting, I feel, is a bit different from a lot of others in that you have now, I think, what some would say, two marginalized communities that have been affected, the LGBT community for the victims, but also the Muslim community, because that community has been, I guess, so affected by terrorism, really, in recent times. Your talk, though, also brought in, I think, something else, which is the sort of backlash that this is having on really conservative Christian organizations, where we've seen some people who are saying, you know, we don't want your sympathy. You know, you have, you know, with respect to Christian conservatives, really kind of pushed against gay rights in recent years. And it just seems like this incident is kind of bringing together all of that.
Yeah, no, I think you put it together, or you put it quite simply there. It really is bringing all of those communities together, and you know, from the outpouring of support that I've seen on social media, that I'm seeing at these vigils that are coming together, talking to people in the community, is that everyone is really here to help in our community. I can really only speak for our community, It seems like the folks here in Orlando say, you know what, it doesn't matter, gay, straight, whatever your religion is, we are one city, we're coming together, and we're going to help each other through this.
Thanks to contributing Florida Public Radio stations and our guests throughout the year. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. I'm Lynn Hatter. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance, and we'll talk again in the new year.